so long as I'm not speaking over people.
It might interfere with your freedom to communicate is all I'm thinking, you know? If you don't
used to that, I can't even tell you. Okay.
So, you're going to leave the Jabra on and you're going to record your voice in your iPhone there on voice recorder. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Hello and welcome to the Culturefile debate, or given that it's all of us taking part today are alone somewhere around the world, let's call it the Culturefile webinar, because this time we're using an online alternative to gathering to talk about online alternatives to gatherings. Everyone from national theatres to dive bars are dipping their toes in online performance, but are they creating temporary substitutes, or are we already on the other side of the socially distanced looking glass? Can gigs, concerts and shows ever really come back? What will they be like? Gathered here, there and everywhere to help us with some of the unanswerables, we have our Zoom panel, and they are Nancy Baim, and she's the author of Playing to the Crowd, about the intimate work of artist-fan connections, and she's principal researcher at the Microsoft Research Lab in New England. Hello, Nancy.
Hello.
Next, we have Sherry Hu, who's a journalist and researcher and creator of the Water and Music newsletter, podcast and online community. She researches about innovation, technology and music, and particularly the way startup culture manifests in music. Hello, Sherry.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Coming in from Florence, Italy, is Francesco Dillon, organizer of the Villa Romano Festival in Florence, and a keen fan of chamber music, which must be a good socially distanced option. Hello, Francesco.
Hello.
And just down the road, down the line, we have Matthew Nolan, who's a musician and composer of new soundtracks for silent movies and a promoter of music, not the easiest job right now. Hello, Matthew.
Hi, Luke. Hi, guys.
So we're going to start with a question about audiences and our own place in those audiences. And maybe we just find out. There's a lot of shows and performances and gigs on offer online. Everybody from the guy who's just had one lesson on the violin to the Berliner Philharmonic and everywhere in between is offering to give us free online content. How much of it have we been consuming? So what have we been to virtually that we've enjoyed, or is the experience worth something? Sherry, what have you consumed?
As far as the events that have resonated the most with me, they've been the ones that feel the most intimate and or the ones that are the most visually interesting. So one example is this virtual electronic music festival curated by Porter Robinson, who's an electronic artist, and it was mostly electronic music featured on the lineup. And it was all pre-recorded, but it was the most visually striking, almost like psychedelic, trippy viewing experience that I'd ever seen. A lot of the artists had art projection, displayed behind them on the wall. It was like super colorful and animated that added a ton to the music. It wasn't just us watching them in their rooms.
Fantastic. And what we see there almost immediately is the way that it's not just about presenting the music that you already presented, but, the form is somehow conditioning the aesthetic of what we're, about to receive. Matthew, what did you consume?
I have to say my engagement has been rather limited. I guess I kind of went into a low-level depression when venues and events and gigs got cancelled, because I had so many beautiful events in the diary that I found it difficult to re-engage. The term you use, which I think is utterly appropriate here, is consumption, because I don't find it engaging or necessarily exciting or even entertaining as such. I'm intrigued more by the interface and the experience and what it can evolve to. But so far, I haven't seen an interesting point of evolution from this kind of simple screen-to-person engagement.
Nancy, have you found anything out there that's satisfactory coming at you down the internet webs?
Yeah. The things that I've been the most drawn to have been the people who are doing daily performances. So my partner and I have really been enjoying Neil Finn's performances, where he's at home sometimes with his kids, and for many, many weeks he was doing every single day a performance. And he, in contrast to what Sherry was just saying, he chose to do it audio only because he said he wanted us to be able to do the dishes and walk around the house and be doing other things. And I have to say that after a day of meetings on Zooms and Teams and everything all day long. The last thing I really want to do in my spare time is be staring at screens some more. So I've found that audio only really, really charming. And I really love the way that day after day after day, it sort of accretes and you develop this real sense of togetherness. And he has been an incredible comfort to us and really become, it's gotten, now he's only doing it 2 days a week. And we're almost like, oh no, how are we going to make it through this with only two Neil Finn shows a week?
Francesco, how about you?
I remember that in Italy it was maybe the very early stage. I mean, it happened before. We were not prepared to this. We were not prepared to be so interested to live streaming and all this. It was really a shock in the first stage, mostly for us performing musicians. Really, the first weeks was mostly self-centered and questioning yourself what you want to do, how to react to this. And then, of course, you open up, you see what your friends are doing, how they are answering to these crucial questions. Another interesting thing that was very appreciated by my students, for example, was a great Italian cellist called Mario Brunello, one of the best European cellists right now. Every day he gave a lesson live and really with a kind of project that would cover 24 days. And I think there was a lot of following. It was nice to see this. He's quite a shy and, silent man. So a wise man, I would say, like in his 60s maybe. So it was not a self-exposure, if you know what I mean. It's we have to avoid that being, performers. It's very easy to, I see there is a very subtle line between self-exposure and exercise your ego. And on the contrary, this idea of really giving something, participating to a bigger debate. And I find it very, very delicate, this myself.
Yeah, it's a fascinating line, and maybe people have been a bit brusque about it, but the performers, the musicians need to perform is one of the parts of the equation that we sometimes neglect, but then we see that it's a kind of an unstoppable force that, no gig is possible. They'll still find some way to put themselves before people. And that's not necessarily a pathology, of course, is it? It's art.
Yeah, but still you have to remember that you are speaking with someone else outside, and it's very easy that you are alone in your room and you start making things for yourself or to expose yourself. This I was very aware at first. It gives you more questions, how to do it. So then the answers maybe are a next topic of discussion between us. But for me, it was very clear that it must be something different from what we have right now. You cannot play as you played until yesterday with your routine, with your strong points. You have to question that when you do it online and streaming.
Exactly. It seems there that we've got that there are sort of two complete ends of the spectrum there, where Cherry is appreciating electronic music with an incredible visual component that's really stimulating, and Nancy finds that what she wants is for that to go away in just the music itself. I guess the thing I suppose we could look at first, Nancy, is that, there's a recency fallacy around all this online performing. This didn't just start in the COVID pandemic. In fact, for many years, people have thought, oh, this is where I need to take my performance, my career.
Oh, yeah. So the Rolling Stones in 1994 decided that they were going to do a live concert on what was then called the M-Bone, which was the infrastructure on which the really nascent internet was running. And a couple of things happened with that, one of which was that the M-Bone was completely open. There was no security. And so a bunch of computer scientists at Xerox PARC, which it's one of the primary sites of a lot of early innovation around computing, the computer scientists went out in the parking garage and they hijacked the M-Bone and made themselves the opening act for the Rolling Stones. And then, of course, the other thing that happened is that although the Stones were performing, hardly anybody could see it. So it was really being done for the press as a PR stunt rather than an actual effort to engage audiences. And then, you know, they didn't really follow up on it either.
Nancy raises the point there, Sherry, that while there is a kind of long tradition of this happening, what's different is it might be the only avenue for artists to expand their career, and it might be the only way to find a way of creating a career that pays.
Yeah, what something that I've noticed just over the past couple months, I guess for me and for a lot of people in the US and to an extent globally as well, the day that South by Southwest got canceled, which I believe was March 6th, in the couple days after that, so many artists who would have performed at that showcase, and in which case like several hundred, started to like bring all of their showcases online live. And it was just like a I guess like groupthink, like seeing both groupthink and also of course by necessity to perform and to reach fans, just like flocking to live streaming because everyone else was doing it. But then now I'm seeing this shift where it's not like you have to like force yourself to live stream. Like I'm noticing more people are asking this question of, is live streaming like really serving the art that I'm making or like the creative vision that I have? Or like, how can I use live streaming as a tool to help serve the vision that I have, as opposed to, oh gosh, everyone's live streaming, I gotta go on there and like start live streaming every week now. I think, I guess my personal opinion, I think that's the wrong way to think about it. Especially, yeah, going to the monetization part in exchange for like losing all of your touring income, essentially like making content for free. Like that seems like a very significant imbalance financially.
Presumably in the deep history of music, the idea of sitting and watching somebody playing music rather than playing it and making it yourself must have been an odd concept to get your head around it in the beginning. Nancy, did you want to come in there?
Well, I just love your point about the transition from music as a thing that everybody makes to a thing that you sit and watch, which was very much an invention. You know, I mean, the whole category of somebody being a musician rather than a person who might at that particular moment be playing a drum, which would then get passed to somebody else, is a thing that had to be invented. It wasn't a given. And it's not really until the 1600s, which of course seems like a long time ago to us, but if you think about the first musical instrument that we have ever found being 40,000 years before Christ, the bone flutes, there was music for a very, very long time before music as a thing that you sat down and listened to ever happened. So it is a relatively modern invention, this idea of music as a consumptive practice rather than a participatory practice. I don't think that the internet sets us up very nicely to go back to it as, or this particular COVID moment sets it up very nicely as a time to go to participation in the sense of people performing together. And even artists are finding it really hard to perform together when they're in quarantine in different places. But I do think it's a moment where the spectators can be more actively engaged with the process because, like Matthews was saying, right, we are all of us isolated and many of us are quite depressed, and musicians are in no way immune to that, especially if they're used to going out and performing as part of their practice of self-care and wellness. So I do think that the role of the audiences in supporting musicians in this moment is in some ways greater than it has been before. Bandcamp is a really nice example of that when they've been doing their today we're waiving our fees and all the money is going direct to artists for all the sales, and you see people just buying extraordinary amounts of music. Unlike Matthew, I haven't been listening to very much music right now, but boy, have I been buying it. I got a huge stash to listen to and I'm ready to start listening again. Yeah.
I did have that thought at some point during this sort of peak television notion. I was saying, God, if they would just stop producing stuff for a while and then we'd just watch and listen to all the stuff that was there. And I didn't mean to cause the pandemic by having that thought, but it seems like we've got a pause where we can actually have a look at some of the things that have been produced, and this brevity of human life is somehow preventing us from getting to. Francesco, In terms of the world of music you work in terms of classical music, it feels like there's a mismatch between classical and operatic musicians and chamber musicians having to find a place for themselves in the world where direct fan interaction is a kind of constant demand of them.
I think, you know, I'm quite an open kind of classical musician myself because I cannot limitate myself to old music, but I'm very open to new music too, and collaboration with composers is really vital for me. For example, I have a concert next month in Modena near Bologna. I had this concert planned in beginning of May, and the Chamber Music Society there decided not to have, of course, the live concert with the live audience, but to reschedule and have the theater ready to live stream and rethink the old program. So, for example, I felt immediately that my original program, you know, Beethoven, two sonatas by Beethoven for cello and piano, a Brahms sonata, a Debussy sonata, you know, a very classical one. I felt it was completely wrong for this kind of listening and for this kind of sharing. So, for example, I rethought completely my program, and I'm going in the direction of shorter pieces, for example, and a strong narration behind the concert. So my narration in that sense is a program based on the idea, this topos of cello being the closest instrument to human voice. And I think this is much more what I want to do in such a context, you know, without the audience, alone, basically with the pianist in a big theater and thinking of an audience that is not there. I don't feel that the old forms would suit very well, you know. In that sense, I would look for a secret ritualistic performance rather than explicit one.
Sherry, this idea that the musician can't really be a musician unless they're already an entrepreneur, it was kind of an emerging figure of the new musician, but now it seems absolutely implausible that somebody might just make music as what they spent their time at.
Yeah, the higher level concept of musician as entrepreneur has, like, I think, been around as long as, like, professional musicians have been around. Like, you can think entrepreneurially without necessarily just being, you know, by yourself. You can have a team around you, but still act entrepreneurially in terms of the kinds of opportunities you seek out. But especially nowadays, and this is not just in music, I've heard almost the exact same narrative and shift in the book publishing world, interestingly, is that in terms of, like, early stage artist development and, like, growing a career really early on, labels, or I guess the equivalent of book publishers in the literary world, have essentially offloaded all of that risk to the artists themselves. I would say a major label, with only a handful of exceptions, if you look at the deals that they sign and, like, at what point in the artist's career they sign them, it's less about, like, artist development and more about, like, scaling an artist to a certain mainstream level beyond what they've already been able to achieve. There's so many, like, I guess, higher level financial reasons why this might be the case. I'm thinking especially, like, the residual effects of piracy, how, you know, recorded music revenue was going down for, like, 15 years straight, like, in the aggregate. And so, like, labels wanted to reduce risk, and so they didn't want to take on that risk. And so, yeah, now that is by necessity kind of forced onto these artists. And so they do have to think not just about their music, but how they're going to market it, how they're going to build an audience around it, how they're going to brand it. It's becoming increasingly difficult to, I guess, like, silo each of those different functions to a different team member or to, like, a different department in a label that you might not ever get access to for, like, a couple of years. So there's, like, I guess, a more cynical side to this and that, yeah, like, artists just so much more is just, like, riding on themselves for their early success. But there's something that I think is, like, super relevant to the concept of entrepreneurship or building a business is just understanding your audience and really understanding what they want. So I think, like, that mindset in terms of, like, serving fans in addition to, you know, just creating art for art's sake, I think that definitely has ties to startup entrepreneurship, because in the startup world, you would never build a product if it didn't have a use case for someone in the world, if it wasn't serving someone.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we're looking at it from a kind of producer end, and maybe what we should be talking about is how the audience has been remade, that the audience aren't the same people anymore.
The notion of an audience is, or the concept of an audience is, has been such a slippery concept anyway, or idea anyway. And how it's getting reconfigured at the moment, I find, you know, kind of troubling. And I do find, I think this is something that Sherry has alluded to, which is the shifting of responsibility onto the artist for that I've seen ramp up in the last 6 to 7 years for taking ownership around kind of marketing and PR and maintaining that close relationship with your audience. And if things go awry, then the artist gets blamed. And that shifting of blame excessively so onto the artist, but the onus is not on them to sell tickets. Whereas now, and with most promoters that I work with and I see operating in Dublin and beyond, they place excessive pressure on artists to maintain that relationship and take almost exclusive responsibility for generating revenue.
Sherry, I suppose, you know, when you're talking about what a major artist can do, maybe what Travis Scott did in Fortnite, maybe tell us a little bit about that. That seems to be the beginning of an arms race, because only an artist of huge stature can achieve something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did want to bring this up in the early conversation around audiences and how they are changing. So within like a couple of weeks between mid-March and early April, they're really interesting and to me, like totally unexpected trends in media consumption, whereby in the aggregate, audio streaming consumption went down. So it was like down for a couple of weeks, whereas consumption of games and film and TV and other like more immersive long form audiovisual media, like it skyrocketed. Like gaming companies are actually, I think, like benefiting quite a lot from this current time. So as a record label who's like, or an artist who's, you know, relied a lot on recording or streaming to at least get an audience, let alone earn some sort of income. If you're seeing this trend, like people aren't listening to Spotify as much, but they're playing a lot more games. You kind of want to go where the people are, right? Like thinking about like serving the users, being where they already are. And so yeah, the Travis Scott Fortnite concert was a really interesting example because it was all premeditated. It was all pre-animated. The Travis Scott Fortnite show, quote unquote, was not live. I didn't see it within the game, but I saw the video after the fact. And like, even in a 2D version, I could totally understand the appeal of it because Travis Scott in the game was like so much larger than life, you know, kind of like towering over the city.
And your game avatars were, this is within the game, your actual, this happened one day, people were playing and suddenly this rapper appeared. So you're able to move your avatars around the performance and then certain parts of the performance are given to you, I think.
Yes, absolutely. And I'd even heard stories of like people like trying to like run to the show, but then like getting killed off by another like person in the game on the way to go to the show, which is like so funny, so ridiculous, and would only happen in the game. But like, it makes it feel like that much more like you're present there, I guess, as opposed to just watching in a more detached way. But I think like in concept, this could be super interesting, and it ties to something that I'm, as a fan, I'm always really excited by when I like, I guess, like discover a new artist and I see that they've built a whole world around their music. It doesn't have to be within a game. Just like I could really tell that there's like a wider world that's driving the narrative of the music or of the album. It's like super like visually striking or like at least like visually consistent. Games just happen to be like, I guess, a ready-made environment that take that to an extreme in terms of making that world a lot more interactive too.
The question would be, if you are in a rising generation of potential fans and your experience of live music has been Travis Scott jumping into Fortnite, you might find the local dive bar a bit less appealing. Matthew?
Well, I've found it increasingly difficult over the last few years to get people to connect with live music. As a promoter, it's why I've kind of, you know, hung that hat up for the time being, because it is increasingly difficult to get people to cross, you know, the threshold of their own, you know, their own cross their own doorstep to go out and listen, you know, when they can consume what they want, you know, from the comfort of their own home. So, you know, if that experience is going to become, you know, more intense, more satisfying, more addictive, more compelling, then, you know, how I don't know what we can use to compete with that, you know, other than the very traditional values and the kind of reverie that you get with being with real people in a room. And it's not to kind of, you know, whenever I think about that notion of a reverie, I always feel myself kind of slipping off into some kind of quasi-mystical kind of place thinking about it. But it is an intangible.
I mean, and I guess you all might have something to say on this, but the idea that music is sort of divorced from place is also a relatively new and relatively artificial idea. And so, I mean, when you put on a gig, you often pick a very resonant venue. It's a church, it's a cave. And I suppose that relationship between music and space is one that really is the USP of what we used to call a live music performance.
Well, all I can say is for me, in terms of some of the unusual spaces that I've performed in, it's always been a wonderful challenge to treat that as another instrument that you react to and respond to. And, you know, that can be seen, and I've often seen it as it can be a real challenge from a technical point of view. But from a creative point of view, it can give you so much.
And sometimes you want also to play the wrong thing in the wrong space, because it can be very interesting, you know. But you have to be conscious. Maybe this will be a result of all these difficulties that we are facing now. Some more questions that you will pose yourself before doing things. I'm pretty positive about the future of live music. I don't think it will be over. So I have hope. And for example, in my opinion, a classical music concert, it must be really something that finds back this idea of a ritualistic power. I don't know.
Nancy?
Well, I mean, I think the greatest loss is just the loss of life, which is so staggering and so upsetting. And if you stop and allow yourself to think about it, is just devastating. The loss of live music matters a lot. I mean, there's a kind of communal experience and a experience of epiphany that I personally experience pretty much only during peak moments of live performance. And I miss that sense of being connected to something higher and more glorious than I'm otherwise able to experience. So that's extraordinary losses. I think what I feel has been gained is in some cases a more intimate, quiet sense of connection to people I value. I have seen people like Neil Finn, and there's somebody who has taken very seriously this call to comfort, to perform as a means of offering something to his audience. And I think that's been really beautiful. And as long as I have loved him in all of his various incarnations, I love him a lot more now, because he's really shown that kind of compassion and care for his audience. And it has, in fact, made me calmer and better able to face this time. The other thing I think that I feel as a gain is the quiet and the calm, and being out on roads and there's nobody there, and the return to nature and seeing people. I live in a rural area, and people are walking out in the woods in ways they never did before. And I think that sort of reconnection with nature and vitality of the environment, the natural environment that's happened during this time is really great. And I hope that we don't just rush back to busy, crowded cities and traffic. I hope that we're able to hang on to some of the quiet that has come in this time.
Indeed, I suppose as long as it's the right kind of quiet and not that slightly uncomfortable kind of quiet of a silent concert hall or an empty stage. We're going to add to the quiet now by finishing up this Culturefile webinar. I'd like to thank our guests this time, Nancy Baim, Sherry Hugh, Matthew Nolan and Francesco Dillon. Thank you all for organising your background so nicely and sitting attentively in your little postage stamps as we attempted to see over the horizon and to our brand new world. Bye now.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Luke.
Thanks.
Thank you very much for that.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.